And good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today we're going to be speaking with Ava Gollinger in Caracas, Venezuela. Our listeners will know there are dramatic developments going on in South America. There's been a coup in Honduras, and Ava has written about this. She is a Venezuelan-American and an attorney and a writer and an investigator, and she is the author of The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, published in 2005. I'm sure you get that at a different book list on Bathurst. And there's two matters that we wanted to talk to her today. We were arranging the interview last week. We wanted to talk about the role of President Hugo Chavez on the world stage and his take on developments in the Islamic Republic. That in the interim, we've had this dramatic development, and so we're going to take advantage of the opportunity to also learn what is going on and what the view from Caracas is on the coup in Honduras. And I believe we're joined now by Ava Gollinger. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, hey, thank you very, very much. I know you're busy. You have a terrific website, which is thechavezcode.com. I think people ought to be going to that today. When we originally were planning to do the interview, I was thinking of more global questions, but we've had this very dramatic and startling development in Honduras. And I'll just give it to you. What is going on in your view at the moment with the president? Is he in? I heard he was headed for Caracas. Is he saying anything? And
the
just
president of Honduras?
Yes.
President Zelaya of Honduras. Just to recap for the listeners who aren't aware of the situation, and understand that yesterday in Honduras, the Central American nation of Honduras, a first military coup took place that then evolved into a civil military coup d'état. Mass military soldiers raided the president's residence in the early hours on Sunday morning and violently kidnapped him and forced him onto the presidential aircraft and sent him into exile, and he was received by Costa Rica. And so that's where he ended up yesterday. In the meantime, there was a major media blackout on information in Honduras, and anyway, it was Sunday. Most people weren't aware of what was going on. The mass media wasn't broadcasting the fact that the president had been kidnapped and a coup d'etat was taking place. So a lot of people in Honduras really didn't know what was going on, and things unraveled really quickly. The Congress in Honduras presented a bogus resignation letter from President Manuel Zelaya. And so tried to say that he had resigned, but this was quickly discounted because Telesur, which is a television station that was created here in Venezuela and in South America about 3.5 years ago, actually got into Honduras and has been broadcasting nonstop to reset their images, and then CNN in Spanish is also on the ground there. Mm-hmm. So they've been both broadcasting what's been going on, and so this has gotten out to the international community. And so CNN was actually able to interview Zelaya, President Zelaya from Costa Rica, to confirm or deny the resignation, which, of course, he denied and said he had never written or signed a letter. It was a fake. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the Congress in Honduras proceeded to separate him from power, citing other reasons, primarily the fact that the reason sort of behind this that has excelled it all, accelerated it, this coup d'etat, is because yesterday in Honduras, a sort of national poll had been convened and was going to take place, a national poll meaning like a non-binding referendum where Honduran people were going to be allowed to express their opinion on whether or not in the November elections of this year in Honduras they would want to include a fourth issue on the ballot that would be a question regarding constitutional reform, whether or not to convene an assembly of people in Honduras to redraft or modify the constitution. Mm-hmm. So that was really the only issue that was going to be addressed. There was a non-binding referendum. Nevertheless, the political and economic and military elite in Honduras were terrified that if the people had the opportunity to express their opinion on this issue, on any issue really, that their opinion would not be in line with the opinion of the elite. And yes. So could lead to constitutional reform, which they don't, obviously those that have a tight grasp on power and economic power in the country don't want to allow that. Because Honduras has a very restrictive constitution that doesn't allow for people to really participate in government beyond voting once every 4 years for president. So the idea was to sort of maybe eventually create a more participatory type of democracy in Honduras, but anyway, so they acted to thwart all of that, and so they decided to separate President Manuel Zelaya from power, saying that the non-binding consultative referendum that he was trying to convene for Sunday along with a majority of supporters in the country was illegal, and therefore he had violated the Constitution, so his kidnapping and forced exile had been justified. And so in this coup move, very similar to what took place in Venezuela 7 years ago,
yes,
in April 2002,
yes,
the head of Congress, sworn in as president, he's also a businessman, owner of media, mass media in Honduras, sworn himself in as president and removed all the members of President Zelaya's cabinet from power. In the meantime, Zelaya, who was in Costa Rica, was in constant contact with other regional leaders. The Organization of American States had an emergency meeting yesterday, and they condemned unequivocally the coup d'etat in Honduras and refused to recognize any other government than that of Manuel Zelaya. The United Nations today has done the same thing. In fact, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the whole United Nations, convened a special meeting on the issue on the coup in Honduras, and they have also issued a statement condemning the coup in Honduras and only recognizing Zelaya as the legitimate president. Most other countries in Latin America have done the same. A lot of European nations have also done so. Even the European community made a collective statement. France, President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, made an individual statement for France saying that they condemn the coup and will not recognize any other government in Honduras. President Zelaya is right now in meetings in Managua, Nicaragua, with the other members of the regional group, such as ALBA, which is the Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas, Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, Nicaragua, Honduras, and some Caribbean nations. They've already met since last night. They conducted an emergency meeting. They concluded their meeting this morning, obviously, with a similar type of declaration, condemning the coup, demanding the unconditional return to power of Zelaya, refusing to recognize any coup government in place. And then in a matter of about an hour or so, the real group of nations is going to meet, which is all Latin America and Caribbean nations, the United Nations group. They're going to meet in Managua, in Nicaragua, this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And there's also going to be a meeting of Central American nations. And then tomorrow there's another special meeting in Nicaragua, which is right next to Honduras, part of why they're doing everything there, on the issue again of Honduras and what to do. So President Zelaya is safe, and his foreign minister, Patricio Rodas, who had been kidnapped and beaten by the coup leaders, was also forced into exile in Mexico and appeared around midnight last night in Mexico. We had been worried about her detention all day yesterday, but she has appeared, and he flew to Nicaragua with Mexican President Felipe Calderon, and so they're all meeting there. I just want to add before you ask any questions that the only government that hasn't, still, even today, when Obama made some speeches, gave some remarks from the White House, and so did Secretary of State Clinton, the only government, obviously, is the United States that hasn't clearly condemned this coup d'etat. Clinton's statements today were that the event seemed to be developing into a coup, so it's not yet actually like a coup, developing into a coup.
Secretary Clinton?
I just
wanted to sort of underline that. You say that was Secretary Clinton who said that?
That was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today.
That it was developing into a coup.
Today, she gave statements live this morning from the State Department. Yesterday, the only response from Washington, despite all the responses from United Nations, the Organization of American States, European Community, and all Latin American nations condemning the coup, the U.S. put out a statement from the State Department saying that They were concerned about the actions taken against President Zelaya of Honduras and were calling for a restore of constitutional order and democracy, and that all parties should work together to resolve the situation. Mm. So theirs has been a very ambiguous position.
Yeah. By the way, I want to go into that, but I want to ask you, there's one other sort of shocking matter that a congressman, Cesar Ham, is that his name, was assassinated?
Yes, you know, it's really difficult to get information out of Honduras because even though we have Telesur is there, Telesur has one camera, and they're in Tegucigalpa, which is the capital, and they're at the presidential palace trying to, because that's where the sort of part of the protests are located, obviously, at the presidential palace.
I thought the army was saying they had shot him.
No, I'm not saying it's not confirmed, but I've gotten that same information, but it's coming out of sources, internet radio source that's alternative media, and so we haven't been able, I believe it's probably true, we have some information of around 600 detentions that have taken place. There's mass repression. I mean, I'm watching images as we're talking on Telesur live of the repression taking place in the streets in the capital of Honduras. So there's no question that there's violence and repression. The difficulty, I was saying, is that the coup government has shut down the state media and all alternative media sources. And the regular sort of private media in Honduras is just showing soap operas and, you know, cartoons and regular programming. So no one's really, I mean, the only station that's there broadcasting live is Telesur, and they've got one camera in the capital. So I'm sure there's a lot more stuff happening in the interior of Honduras and in different parts of the city, but it's just hard to get information because the coup government has imposed a curfew in a state of emergency, and there's mass repression. Even the Telesur cameraman was beaten this morning by the Honduran military forces.
I want to tell our listeners, we're speaking to Ava Gullinger. She is in Caracas, and she is the author of The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela. That was published in 2005, a very highly regarded book, and of course there is also a website, thechavezcode.com, and I urge everybody to go to that site to be informed about this crisis. One of the items I saw on your site was that U.S. indicated that they had known some days back that there was something in the works, and they said they had tried to prevent it.
And yeah, the position so far that's come out publicly of the U.S. government, that they talked about actually yesterday, the U.S. ambassador in Honduras, Hugo Jordan, stated yesterday in Honduras, and this got replayed in different media outlets and agencies, that he had been meeting regularly with those involved in the coup the days before and the week before. And what they were trying to do is negotiate with them. You know, why this is the job of the U.S. government? Well, you know, that's obviously because of their immense role in intervening in internal affairs.
Well, the time to have stopped it would have been by simply saying to them, this can't go forward, we don't agree with
it. Well, absolutely.
We'll cut you off at the pockets.
Nevertheless, as someone who's, my book, The Chavez Code, is about the U.S. government back to against President Chavez in April 2002 in Venezuela. And the source of my information, my work, I'm a lawyer and investigator, has been using the Freedom of Information Act to declassify documents from the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And so the Chavez Code is based on those declassified documents. And from documents that I got regarding the coup 7 years ago here in Venezuela, all of the CIA, the U.S. Embassy in Caracas, you know, State Department, everybody, the Pentagon, everybody knew the coup was in the works. Well, of course, they were helping to back it, but there were statements from the U.S. ambassador in Venezuela at the time of the coup in April 2002 saying that he had been meeting with those involved in the coup and he was telling them not to go through with it. So this is kind of a pattern. You know, this is what, I mean, I'm not going to jump to any conclusions yet because I am going to try to do the same type of work and get the documents that will prove it instead of me just speculating. But I would say that the scenario is eerily similar, and that it seems to be a pattern that the United States, behind the scenes, is working with these forces that obviously are their allies. Let's be straight here. I mean, you know, I'm calling them coup leaders, But yes, we're talking about the so-called civil society, the business owners, the Chamber of Commerce members, the political parties that are center, that are center-right, that some may even say, you know, social Democrats, whatever. These are the allies of the United States government. They are the ones that receive the majority of their political and financial support. And so it's not like it's just some, you know, high-level military officers that have run out on their own. Mm-hmm. These are groups and organizations that the United States shares very close ties with, regardless of this, whether it's Obama or Bush or Reagan or Kennedy or Carter or whoever in power,
yes,
in the White House. I mean, these are ongoing relationships that have been cultivated over a long period of time. And so the U.S. ambassador did admit, and the State Department has confirmed that he had been meeting with those involved in this group. Now, my position is that, as the U.S. government said, and I still maintain the same position, if the U.S. government would say today, with Clinton, Secretary Clinton, specifically said the U.S. was not considering, as of right now, but had they said, or if they say, that the United States will suspend aid, economic aid, to Honduras, the coup would not be able to have happened in the first place, and it certainly wouldn't continue right now.
Yes.
Honduras is 100% dependent on the economic aid that it receives from the United States. So the coup leaders, those involved in this coup d'etat in Honduras, could never have executed it, completed it, and continue, you know, insisting upon maintaining now their coup government if they didn't have the assurance, even if it's behind the scenes, of the United States that their economic aid won't be cut off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and by the way, I mean, another thing, of course, I learned at the ChavezCode.com site is that the U.S. has a military base there, and they have trained, I guess, every last officer of the Honduran Army.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, that's the situation for most of Latin America, except now, thankfully, for Venezuela, Cuba, of course, and hopefully in the future, Bolivia. But even in the case of Venezuela, those that were involved in the coup here 7 years ago were School of the Americas trainees, were, you know, also the majority trained or formed in U.S. military institutions. The U.S. government had a major military mission here in Venezuela that, you know, we've now removed. But it's the same in the case of Honduras, but more so. Honduras is a much smaller nation. The U.S. has a military base there in Sotocano. It has about 500 to 600 armed forces there from the United States maintained there, along with equipment. And remember, this is Honduras. This is a country that has been subjected to U.S. invasions, to interventions, to the dirty wars in Central America, to the whole scandal, the Iran-Contra during the Reagan administration, John Negroponte. He was the U.S. ambassador in Honduras. That was only about 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're not... This is a country that has been thoroughly penetrated and dominated by the United States and its military more so than any. And so the U.S. maintains major military training programs there, conducts about 50 or so exercises a year with the Honduran military and the Southcom, the Pentagon's regional sort of body, and provides over $2 million just on the ground coming out of the U.S. embassy of aid to the Honduran military, and it's training, you know, hundreds annually. So, yeah, I mean, it's no surprise. But also, again, one of my conclusions from that sort of analyzing that information is that there's no way that the Honduran armed forces would have acted had they not had the authorization of those stationed on the U.S. military base and those U.S. military attaches that are stationed in Honduras. There's no question that they would have asked had they not had their complicity or their outright approval of the coup.
We're speaking to Eva Gullinger. She's the author of The Chavez Code, a very important book. And, of course, there's thechavezcode.com. There's a question about... I noticed the president of the General Assembly, the UN, he's calling for a meeting. This is the former foreign minister of Nicaragua years and years ago. And he said, well, this is a throwback, but, you know, isn't it true that in recent years there have been a number of actions with the same kind of profile as the one that was unfolding in Honduras? That is, there was talk in Bolivia not that long ago of a potential coup there and a couple of other places. And, of course, we all remember President Aristide in Haiti.
That's right. This is a very similar, this is sort of like a combination, I think, of Haiti and Venezuela, what we're seeing in Honduras, because the Haiti sort of modus operandi was kidnapping the president, forcing him on an airplane, and sending him into exile before anybody really could figure out what was going on. And that's what happened.
They had a letter of resignation in that one, as I recall.
Well, it was forced. And then, of course, at that time, the U.S. government, you know, condemned the situation. But again, the same thing that they're doing right now. This is, you know, I'm telling you, I know that a lot of people had faith and hope in change taking place in the United States with the arrival of Barack Obama in the presidency. But this is a practically identical scenario to that scenario in Haiti in 2004 when the U.S. government did come out and condemn the rupture of constitutional order. But as I was just, you know, citing Hillary Clinton's, the Secretary of State's statement today, not demanding the restoration of the elected Democratic president.
Well, let me ask
and
you.
And that's the place with Aristide in Haiti in 2004, and he was never restored to power. And they just sort of played it out for a few months until elections could take place. And I'm telling you, that's what they're trying to do here. Honduras has elections in November.
Yeah, they're going
to. 5 months.
Yes, they will stroke their chins and wonder and maybe have meetings and meanwhile keep their guy in power.
That's
The press here, it appears that they want to turn this into some sort of an issue with President Chavez in Venezuela, of course, where you are in Caracas. But are you hearing some of that? It's like they start off, they talk about Honduras, but then they say, well, but Chavez is the issue, including the people making this coup. They say, oh, he can come home, but he has to denounce Chavez. Do you think maybe this is, they're thinking of trying to extend this into some kind of an issue with Venezuela?
Well, this already is an issue with Venezuela. This is not just a coup d'etat against Honduras. Mm-hmm. This is a regional coup d'etat against the countries that are members of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas, which are Bolivia, Ecuador, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Honduras, and the islands of Dominica, St. Vincent, and Antigua and Barbados. And so this is an alliance, it's a cooperation agreement, you know, trade, mm-hmm. a form of trade and exchange between nations, but that's not exploitative and competitive. It's based on solidarity and cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are initiatives that are bringing this region together, that are liberating the region from U.S. domination.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are efforts that, of course, the powers, mm-hmm. the world powers are trying to crush these types of initiatives. And so this is a blow, not just to Honduras' democracy, but to regional efforts at integration. And so they're trying to blame Venezuela. In fact, the coup government is saying that the President Zelaya was practically allowing a foreigner to govern. And then, of course, implying President Chavez that, you know, President Chavez is the president of Honduras. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying to say even, you know, there are protests taking place massively in the streets of Honduras. And they're trying to say that they're not Hondurans in the street, they're Venezuelans that have been shipped over there.
Oh, my.
I mean, it's ridiculous. But unfortunately, because there's not much, you know, media coverage of what's happening, this is getting picked up. For example, CNN yesterday and still today have been using that same line, saying, you know, somehow Chavez is involved, Venezuela is involved. This is really about, you know, Venezuela intervening in Honduras' affairs. And even the United States government, in their remarks yesterday at least, have made the similar sort of inferences, saying that no country or group of countries should intervene in the affairs internally of Honduras. I mean, this is just ridiculous. It's part of the reason why multilateral bodies like the Organization of American States exist. It's so that groups of nations can come together and, you know, make collective decisions, particularly in times of emergency like this, where there's been a coup d'etat or rupture in democracy or constitutional order.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's doing. Venezuela is not acting on its own. Venezuela is acting as part of a region, an entire region of nations and an international community that pretty much collectively has assumed the same position. So, yeah, they're trying to turn it into something that's just about, you know, some issue against Chavez and spreading Chavismo throughout the region, but that's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
This is about the Honduran people having the right to determine the type and the type of model that they want to have and build in their country. Do they want it to be the same repressive type of government that, you know, has been set up and structured through their constitution that was created by, interests, or do they want to have a participatory type of democracy?
Yeah, and some of these other states, it was had rumbles from their military. That had to do with issues of referendum, didn't it? I mean, there were presidents who said, you know, we've got to solve some of these regional issues, and they were finding democratic forms such as referendums, and that's when we began to hear the rattling of sabers around. And
that's absolutely right. I mean, generally these types of destabilization actions take place around electoral processes because it's a moment when people are, you know, involved and ready to make big decisions. I mean, we see that everywhere, not just in Latin America. You know, it's the time to attack. It's the time to try to sway public opinion. Mm-hmm. And in this case in Honduras, it was the time to thwart, you know, the people making a decision that the elite forces were against. And so we see, and yeah, of course, the same in Bolivia. At the beginning of this year, they had a constitutional referendum on ratifying a new constitution, and, you know, there were assassination attempts against President Evo Morales. There were,
yes,
you know, all kinds of violence to place in issues. The same takes place here in Venezuela every time we have an electoral process. We have a vibrant opposition here, and they are very violent when it comes to, you know, sort of expressing their will.
Yes.
And so that, sure, there's no surprise that this is taking place, yeah, during this type of scenario, an electoral type process.
Yeah, well, now, just the latter point here, the you cited Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Her first introduction to the her post was when her visit with the, I guess it was the OAS. I thought America suffered a tremendously embarrassing setback, although the way they handled that was not to talk about it. But the vote on saying that Cuba should be a member, and the U.S. was beaten badly and embarrassed, I thought. But you know, I just wonder, is this potentially a situation where the OAS states will actually get together and maybe not be so pleasant with the U.S. about resolving this matter?
Well, they already have issued a declaration. I mean, you know, the Organization of American States is a voluntary multilateral body. They don't really have any kind of authority to obligate nations to act certain ways. The only option that they would have, and this will be decided tomorrow, is to suspend Honduras from the membership of the Organization of American States until the coup government steps down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going to be discussed tomorrow if the coup government is still in place.
Oh.
So, but beyond that, there's not much they can do, and I think the United States would be against that. So, but what we could see happening, you know, would be the same, a similar type of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so far what we're seeing with the statements coming out of Washington, they're not joining in the rest of the nations in the region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to say they are, but they're maintaining this ambiguous position and wanting to, when what they're doing with that, because many would say, oh, but that's just how Obama is, he's more measured, he's not quick to make decisions like Bush was, for example. But, you know, this is what diplomacy and politics is all about. You need to think quick on your feet. You need to make decisions in critical moments that are clear and concise and determined.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama's not showed that, you know, the same thing happened with Iran.
Yeah.
He was never clear on his position regarding what took place in Iran with the with the elections there, about 2-3 weeks ago.
Yes.
And
he was unhappy with Venezuela in that matter, since the president pointed out that there was sign of U.S. meddling in that situation.
There is sign of, personally, as someone who investigates and writes on U.S. foreign policy and U.S. relations with Latin America and with some other countries, I mean, there's always some kind of U.S. Investment and interest and intervention, because the U.S. is an empire that has strategic interests everywhere around the world.
And it's very unselfconscious about it. Am I right? I mean, the U.S. seems to have this. I think it was Noam Chomsky, might have made the comment that the U.S. Always presumes that it's sitting at the center of the table and everything is going on around it.
That's right.
And so it doesn't even think maybe we shouldn't say something, you know.
Well, Or whatever we say needs to be...
Or go along with other people, listen to the people.
Recognizes the existence of not just, a world community, but other models of democracy, other cultures. To not assume that everything should be just like it is in the United States, everywhere else, and everyone needs to follow that same exact model and
yes.
lifestyle.
Yes.
That's what we've seen, in the case of Iran. That's what we're seeing even here. The United States is right now the only country in the case of the coup in Honduras that has even referred to the coup leaders as the other party involved and has even indicated that the coup, people that have just violently overthrown an elected president, kidnapped him in the middle of the night and forced him out of the country and are now in the streets imposing curfews and states of emergency and repressing the people and assassinating people, that the United States would even consider that these people in charge of this kind of repression and mass human rights violation should be part of some kind of dialogue and negotiation. That wouldn't be the case if it was, Saddam Hussein in Iraq or Osama bin Laden or anyone else who's considered an enemy of the United States. But again, I repeat, these people that have taken power in Honduras are the allies mm-hmm. of Washington and of U.S. interests. And so...
Yeah, apparently they're getting great coverage in the Miami Herald. Your column at thechavezcode.com points out that Miami Herald is interviewing all their admirers and supporters.
Well, it's no surprise, though, that in the United States, those Hondurans that are living in the United States...
Most of them seem to be
in
Miami seems to be their favorite address.
Well, Miami, in the case of Honduras, they're more actually in Los Angeles, but... Honduras is a nation that was severely affected by the war that the Reagan administration conducted in Central America in the 80s. And there were a large number of refugees that flowed over the border into the United States. And at that time, the United States government made a decision to offer those refugees a temporary protected status, not a green card or permanent residency, but they could work and reside in the country. And this same type of status is renewed annually. And so a large majority of Hondurans that live in the United States are those that came over with that status. Many established families had kids there, have whole lives there, but they're not citizens of the U.S. and they're not even legal residents. They're dependent every year on renewing the status. And should the United States government decide to revoke that status, which they threaten to do every time a leftist president wins office or runs mm-hmm. as a candidate in Central America, then the U.S. has threatened that they'll revoke the status, and all the Hondurans that are in the United States that don't have green card citizenship will be forced into deportation.
Uh-huh.
So can you imagine people that have been living for 20, 30 years, they've raised their families, their kids are U.S. citizens, they have homes, they've made investments in the United States, would be forced to go back to Honduras. And so this is, a lot of Hondurans who live in the United States will just do anything to protect that status that they have that is directly connected to the U.S. government approving whatever takes place in their country.
In the history of the country, it was called indentured servants, huh?
Something very similar. It's very sad. El Salvador is under the same situation as is Nicaragua, though Nicaragua less so because mm-hmm. they've had more resistance to that type of domination. But certainly, it's a major issue in what's taking place right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, the Hondurans in the United States that you may see in some media are saying, oh, well, the coup was justified. We didn't like that Zelaya guy anyway, because they were all terrified that, the longer Zelaya stayed in power or leftist governments in power, the possibility of them being deported to Honduras because the U.S., would revoke their status to take place.
Wow.
And then vice versa. On the Honduran side, one of their number one sources of income are the money that Hondurans are sending from the United States to Honduras. So if they were to all get deported, Honduras would lose a huge source of income. It's a very sort of sad situation.
That is, I really appreciate that detail. And by the way, I have to say, reading your site and your book, I find situation, even though this is an ugly moment, pretty encouraging. Ava Gullinger, we're very grateful you took the time. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Ava Gullinger. She is the author of The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, published in 2005. And I know I've seen it at a different book list, so I recommend you actually get a copy of that. She has a website by that same name, thechavezcode.com. It might be Chavez Code, maybe, you know, might want to drop the. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back. We're going to talk to Robin Philpott, who is a publisher and author, about a new book called A People's History of Quebec. So we'll be just a moment. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Phil Condon couldn't be here today, but I got to make sure I make an announcement. A project he's working on, the Free Ezra project. Go to freeezra.org. This is a gentleman, an Israeli, who has been a strong supporter of Palestinian people fighting against the destruction of their homes, various other things. And he's a regular guy. He's a plumber by trade. He speaks Arabic. He's a good, regarded by the Palestinians as a good friend. And he got some kind of altercation with the Israeli police authorities, and he's facing jail. I think he's on bail at the moment, but he's doing court, and I think it's in the next few days. So please go to www.freeezra.org. He's being supported by Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, and others. Is a great story. You should know about it. We'll come back to him on this program in the future. And just remind you, you can get us on the website, taylor-report.com. For example, Ava Gullinger's interview a few moments ago will be posted there soon. And you can always write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Just one last thing about Ava. I was originally wanted to speak to her because I wanted her to talk about the support by Hugo Chavez for the government of the Islamic Republic. And we touched on it a bit, but I think listeners of Taylor Report ought to see what Hugo Chavez and others in the, what is called the Southern Hemisphere have had to say about the elections and their differences with the U.S. approach to matters in the Islamic Republic. So we're joined now by Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Yes. Hi, Phil. How are you?
Very good. Sorry to keep you waiting. I promised to call you about a few moments earlier. And you have a very handsome book here, A People's History of Quebec. The author is Jacques
La Cossière. Yeah.
I could have said it, but except for the moment I say to myself, Phil, you don't speak French, then my tongue goes into three or four knots. Now, he's a celebrated author. He's identified as Pierre Burton of Quebec, but maybe Pierre Burton ought to be called the La Cossière of English Canada.
Yeah. I would say he's a popular. He's made history a very popular subject. I would say he's more rigorous as a
That's
researcher.
A great sin, of course. I mean,
but he's also more rigorous, I think, than Pierre Burton was. Less romantic.
By the way, the two of them in the same room would have been something, huh?
Oh, that's for sure.
The telling Canada's story. Maybe we could have arranged a duel or something.
No, it would have been an interesting thing because Jacques Lacourtier is still alive, unlike mm-hmm. Gilbert. He's in his 70s, but still talking, speaking, writing regularly. And so this was a book. And in fact, this book we put out, A People's History of Quebec, that's just come out, mm-hmm. is a translation and an adaptation of a book. It's part of a five-book series.
That five volume history, the popular history of Quebec.
Yeah, and it's sold up to 300,000 books in Quebec alone. So it's a very popular book, and it's also made history something that everybody can read and be interested in. And so that was the approach. That was our idea, was what that does not exist in English. If people want to read the history of Quebec, it's drowned in a bigger book, the history of Canada, usually treated as something secondary regional. And so this is the first, I would say.
Yeah, well, the Canadian story has always been two stories. Anybody, minimally, but and certainly the great contest over hegemony, both in states, Britain and France, and then religion, there is a very touchy, and then of course language. Just to give people a taste or an idea of what he talks about, he discusses the fact that, which is not often mentioned, that. The Canadian Parliament was burned down in and it was in Montreal. And
exactly.
And pretty shocking. I mean, and it was after that that the Parliament was moved to Ottawa. But
it moved. Let me tell you what the background. You know, the rebellions in 1837, 1838 was what the Mackenzie led a rebellion. Yeah.
You commemorated in Quebec, and we blush about it in Ontario.
And you've forgotten it, at least officially forgotten it, although not everybody, but here we it's a holiday, the 24th of May now is called Patriots Day, and it was in celebration of the Patriots Revolt in 1837 and 1838, and there was brutal repression after that. Many people were hanged.
Yes,
and hanged in Ontario, in Yonge Street, but many here in Montreal.
More, I think there were more hanged in Quebec, right?
There was more. There was more brutality and burning of fields.
Actually, more fighting. It was a more extensive combat.
And we
had a kind of rebellion that burnt out after the showdown on Yonge Street.
Yeah, and here, in fact, one time the Patriots actually beat the British Army. In one confrontation at the time, there were many people banished at the time, and they burned all the land around wherever there were any patriot activity. They burned all the houses, all the barns, everything, you know, that was used, and so they just really made a mess of the place. And in fact, there's a famous song which came out of that, which people may know, Un Canadien Errant, which was sung, by the way, by Puzzles, interesting to know, and it was also sung by Leonard Cohen, and that song was written shortly thereafter. But anyway, to get back to this, after that rebellion, then Canada, they've created a United Canada, and instead of having two provinces or two colonies at the time, Upper and Lower Canada, they created a United Canada with a goal of assimilating the French-speaking population for good. In other words, drowning them out. And but then there was an attempt to find a reform government. During that period, the people who had lost goods and lost land and lost homes during the repression. In Upper Canada, meaning in Toronto and that area, were compensated by what they called a rebellion losses bill in Upper Canada. Went by without any problem. But then when they tried to adopt a similar law for Lower Canada or Quebec, the English-speaking people just went crazy and led by none other than the Montreal Gazette. They started the Montreal
Gazette. As a paper with a sense of tradition.
Right, exactly. And the Montreal Gazette, the same paper that still exists here, called on the English to demonstrate and that their only command was their blood, their Anglo-Saxon blood. And so they went and demonstrated at the Parliament of what was the Parliament of United Canada, which is in was in Old Montreal, and they smashed into the Parliament in opposition to this bill, which was only to compensate those who had lost land and lost products, lost goods, and their homes. It wasn't to compensate any of the rebels themselves, you know. And so they broke into the Parliament, and they set fire to the parliament and burnt it to the ground. They
together with one of our great libraries, right? There was a library there.
Huge library.
And that was
totally destroyed. They destroyed a huge picture of Papineau, but saved the picture of Queen Victoria, and that picture of Queen Victoria is still sitting. And
my gosh, you already had a picture of her?
Yeah, this was, this was 49. She'd been in power for 12 years. You know, she'd been queen for 12 years. And
she's only queen for 200.
Yeah, right. And that painting is still sitting in the Senate in Ottawa. So it was a real mess. And so from that point on, the Crown decided they had to create the capital somewhere near Montreal, because Montreal was the biggest city, but not in Montreal. So they chose a place called Bytown, which was about a two-horse town on the Ottawa River, which is now Ottawa. And that's why capital is there. Yeah, in other words, they have three horses now
mm-hmm.
and one hockey team. So, but I mean, they figured they couldn't put the capital here in Montreal after that event.
And by the way, in that wild attack, the governor general had to flee himself because the British authorities agreed that if you were going to compensate the English Canadians, you also had to compensate the French.
Exactly.
And they thought that was reasonable, and so they not only they attacked Parliament and burned the library, but he narrowly escaped. They attacked him. He was in a carriage, in my memory, and he just barely got out of there.
Yeah, exactly, and he and then they marched against on La Fontaine's house, and they gave him a lot of trouble, and Cartier, it was at that time the crown.
And it was nakedly racial, right? I mean, this book has lovely quotes in it, and one of them that jumped out at me was that call, which was that said, "We're appealing to your blood."
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to act on your blood.
They said we have to be English and not British, because British meant, of course, the British would englobe or encompass the Scots, the Irish, and the French, and the Canadians, the French Canadians. Mm-hmm. But they said, no, we're not British, we're English, and we have to march according to our Anglo-Saxon blood against this.
A very scary moment. It's odd we haven't had any great movies about it.
exactly. Well, unfortunately, people have, because of the way history goes, sometimes start thinking that it was the French who burned it down.
Yes, exactly. Actually, I saw a children's school book a few years ago, and I was reading it, and I couldn't tell who had burned it. They said, and a mob burned Parliament. Oh, really?
Exactly.
What was the slogan? Where is my vote? What were they? Yeah. It doesn't say who they were. It's hardly helpful for a child. No wonder children, by the way, completely alienated from history. If you're not going to tell them anything in order to give them a hook to understand.
Yeah.
I want to remind everybody, we're talking to Robin Philpott. The book is A People's History of Quebec, La Coursière.
Jacques Lacoursière.
Yeah. And this book, just for our listeners here to know, you better get a copy of this, because 300,000 copies of his five-volume Popular History of Quebec have been sold in Quebec.
Exactly.
It's time to catch up here. We're a little bit off the pace.
Yeah, and it's available. It'll be available in bookstores. And here I'll make a plug, because it's Baraka Books, a new publishing house.
Yeah, Baraka Books.
It'll be available in bookstores this Thursday, as of July 2nd. And it's it's the first time that a book has come out which treats Quebec history as an entity in itself. And I think it's extremely important for people, especially, I would say, well, for everybody, but I would say for new arrivals to Canada and to Quebec, to realize where the independence movement comes from, why Quebec is a special, it's not just a region, another region of Canada, it's a nation. I mean,
the evolution of what people think they mean when they say Canadian identity. You go into the issues here, he goes into the issues of conscription and then country nearly falling apart during, in crisis over World War I and
sure. Sure.
And why there's a different take on things. You know, the sociologists have been pointing this out for years. I mean, if English Canada has one opinion, French Canada usually has another. And it's
also
rooted here, and this book tells you why.
It's also germane to North American history. And it's one thing that people have not been able to, you know, the United States, Canada, Quebec, this, you know, where is, you know, the whole exploration of the center of the continent, why you have names like Chicago, which is a French rendition of an Indian word, why you have words like Des Moines, Des Moines, Iowa, Boise, Idaho, all those names that have been named in North America.
The first
come
place,
from
first place
explorers.
I went deer, I'm sorry, just for the first time I ever went deer hunting, we had to stop and have coffee in a town called Liebeck.
Really?
Yeah, because a French explorer had been killed by a bear there. His name was Liebeck.
Ah, there you go.
And of course,
and I mean, the whole of North America.
I apologize to him. I probably mispronounced it, but yeah. they were everywhere.
And it, in fact, they controlled the French base, and they were people who came out of Quebec City and Montreal, and they controlled probably 80% of the North American continent, only because they were able to work closely in alliance with the native people.
By the way, you quote Jack Kerouac on that, which is very nice. Tell that story about how Kerouac described the behavior of the French on the continent.
Kerouac said, it's in his book called Visions of Girard, where he says he was very proud of his, what he called his Indian and French background. Of course, he came from the lower St. Lawrence River area originally. His family did.
He spoke
and
French
he,
as a child.
He spoke French until he was 6 years old. But he talked in one of his books about, he said, how hardy these peoples must have been who fought in the plains of Abraham, and the peoples they embrothered in order to fight against potent, surly England, and the potent, surly English. And this was, he was writing this in Lowell, Massachusetts. But I mean, he was very aware of this history of the French, who became what you call the Canadiens in North America, and it's something that is basically, I would say, it's too little known, both to Americans and Canadians, the history. And that's one of the things we're trying to fight against by bringing out this book, which is
it's called the first. I like the title. It's called the first concise English language history of Quebec. And it has, and we're speaking, by the way, to Robin Philpott, the publisher. I can't let pass in the promotion sheet I read, it says that the pre-conquest ginseng boom with exports to China. Now, somebody's going to think you've been smoking something funny.
That's a Jesuit connection in about
17. Oh, sure, there's a Jesuit behind everything.
But in a good sense, because there were Jesuits in China, and they one of a Jesuit by the name of Lafitteau, who was also wrote a lot of books about, and the books are available in English, Lafitteau's books. He heard that the Chinese were very interested in importing ginseng from France, but France would get it from North America. And everybody just all of a sudden started to produce ginseng because the Iroquois used it, and the Canadians, the Canadiens, who were the French who were here, started developing it, and they would export it to France and then to China. But then it became, you know, with any get-rich scheme, everybody started producing just that along the St. Lawrence Valley. But then in order to make more money, they started harvesting it in May instead of September, and drying it too quickly in ovens. And of course it lost its aphrodisiac quality.
So the Chinese decided it wasn't the real McCoy anymore.
Yeah, because it wasn't working anymore, and they basically did. It lasted about 20 years.
But the market was China.
Market was China.
And some of the people bringing this crop in were Mohawk?
They were Mohawk, and then, I mean, it wasn't just the Mohawks, but it was the French
that's a great story. By the way, what year are we talking about?
We're talking about between 1718 and about 1750.
Right.
And the conquest was in
the ginseng boom in Quebec.
Yeah.
I got to add, there's another historical moment which I really think people ought to know more about, and this was the Jewish Emancipation Act of 1832, which was the first in the British Empire, and it was adopted thanks to Louis-Joseph Papineau and the Patriot Party. And of course, he was one of those that they wanted to hang.
And he was, in the book, we reproduced a reward poster for him, where they posted all over during the revolt. But in 1832, there were Jews in Quebec from about the time of the conquest, and one of them, a guy named Hart, had been elected in 1807 in Three Rivers, but he couldn't sit because he had to take a Christian oath at that time in throughout the British Empire, Protestant Christian oath, and so he couldn't sit, and then he was re-elected by the people, but then it took a certain while, and so the Jews started to petition for some kind of recognition. They were in what you would call a legal vacuum for about 20 years. They had no, for instance, marriage licenses and so on. Mm-hmm. And so they petitioned, and it was the Patriot Party which took on the petition and pushed it through the Legislative Assembly in 1832, and it's called the Jewish Emancipation Act. And it was only happened here in Lower Canada, or what has become Quebec, in the current, which is the ancestor of the current National Assembly. And you know, it took another 15 years before Upper Canada did that, and 27 years before the British Empire passed an equivalent act, which was Jewish Emancipation. So, and this was done by the people who led the revolts in 1837, popular government inspired by Republican ideas, by the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and revolutions in Latin America at that time, too.
Yeah.
So,
Bolivar, you're the only ones who have a statue of Bolivar north of America, and north of the Los Estados Unidos. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I'm in Quebec City.
Yeah. I don't believe we're going to be civilized till we get one here in Toronto, but we've got a long wait. Robin Philpott, we're going to have to go. We're really grateful. A People's History of Quebec, and it's out and be available in bookstores July 2nd, you say?
Exactly. Published by Barrica Books, and so I hope they enjoy it. I hope you enjoy it.
Okay, thank you, Robin. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye. And for the Taylor Report, I remind you, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and of course, go to our website, taylor-report.com. We had Ava Gullinger on earlier. We're very grateful that she could be here, and I want to thank Benny for great work, and we hope we'll be with you next week.